good?
Yeah.
Cool. Hi everyone, welcome. Thank you for waiting while we get all set up here. Thanks for coming. I know lots of you, but for those of you that don't know me, I'm the volunteer manager at CITR and Discorder. My name is Eleanor. And we're really excited to be putting on this workshop and have Celia hosting it for us. So, yeah, before we begin, I just want to do a territory acknowledgement. CITR is located on unceded territories of the Hunkamingam-speaking Musqueam people. We try to hold this knowledge in the work that we do as much as we can, different initiatives, programming. It's an ongoing thing, but this workshop is part of that. So thanks for joining us and being part of the discussion. We really appreciate it. So a little bit about Celia before we start. So Celia is from the Squamish Nation. She lives in East Vancouver. In 2016, she graduated from the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program here at UBC. She was CITR's first Indigenous Collective Coordinator. She started the show that still airs to this day called Unceded Airwaves. It's fantastic. You should tune in and check it out, and check out all their old podcasts as well. When she was doing her degree here at UBC, she also created her she did her practicum placement at CITR and created a podcast series called Mingling with the Matriarchs, which is actually when I met her and we got to do a little interview and chat about it. And also definitely recommend listening to that if you get a chance. You can find it on the CITR website. So currently Celia is studying her language, Squamish Snechen, full-time at Simon Fraser in Vancouver. And just welcome to Celia.
Thank you, Eleanor. Halsh tuk nutnut, eok tanoyap, halsh and squalowin, quins quach nomiap, tietzits, chinkwomen tomiap, ta hamasquiam stamul, chinkwomen tomiap, ta hamasquiam stamul, chit nam, etiti, nails, ta ochomeo, nails, ta hamasquiam. Chinkwomen tomiap, eok, stam, quiz, nam, etiti, tietzits. Not to quite natum to uns. So hello, my name is Celia Joseph. I come from the Squamish and Stenamel, Squamish and Stenamel First Nations on my father's side, and I'm British and Jewish on my mom's. Eleanor really did a great job in kind of summarizing what I've been up to in the last little while, and I'm really happy to be here and see so many familiar faces. And David here was a professor that kind of bridged a relationship between First Nations and Indigenous Studies and CITR with his passion for both media and decolonial critical thought, and that was such an important relationship for me. And I got to learn from Duncan, and I got to learn from Hugo and Eleanor, and I got to work with Madeline and learn alongside Madeline, so it's really nice to be back and talk about a really important issue that we all come into the room with different levels of understanding. It's going to mean different things to us because it's something that we're trying to learn about to prevent, but it's also something that might have really hurt you as an individual, that hurts you every day, or you've had an experience that that's been a really negative one. And like coming together as a group just then makes it that much less likely that we'll continue to need to have these conversations and continue to move through spaces feeling unsafe or unheard. So I think I will sit down now. Can you all still kind of see me and hear me? This is a bit more comfortable for me. So appropriation, what's yours is mine. It's a deep-seated issue embedded in all sorts of things, but the most important things to note are power and privilege. It's both invisibility and hyper-visibility of people, of cultures, of minorities, but it's most importantly about a disregard of an entire context. It takes one aspect out of a greater context, isolates it, and takes that without permission.
And there is a hip picture from Charlene Lee's Instagram of some of my own sacred medicine being stylized and reproduced for sale by a non-Indigenous company. And that's just the image I chose for the kind of underlying assumption of what's yours is mine, because anything of my culture or of a minority's culture is up for grabs, is up for taking without repercussion. I happen to love Charlene Lee as a store, but that's the type of thing that we navigate on a daily basis, right? So, power and privilege. Thinking about how this operates within the greater context of appropriation. And it can be challenging having these types of conversations, because what's obvious for some isn't obvious for others, and that's not like a necessary, like it's not necessarily a shortcoming. But I had some of these conversations for 5 years over the duration of my degree, and could really understand how some of these things operate, or as a person of color, experience the world differently when I see something that triggers a response that I know to be appropriation. But as a kind of general definition, you have people in a position of power, or that have a certain privilege over another group, that can move in and out of a space utilizing aspects of someone's culture and be unmarked by it. You can move in and out of a space wearing a headdress, but you're not going to be racialized, and you're not going to have the same experience of potential violence or discrimination or oppression that a person of color would have in that same instance. Or it can detach something entirely away from its cultural context in a very disrespectful way, but there you need not feel any repercussions, because what's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. And so we're continually bombarded with images of appropriation, whether it's in music, whether it's in fashion, whether it's in movies, TV, in magazines. And I can only speak to my own identity as an Indigenous woman as to how it affects me, or my own personal experiences moving through the world witnessing it that way. But I can tell you that all people of color are putting up with this shit on a daily basis. And this just kind of dips into just to spark some images that kind of point to some of these issues. And I really wanted to stress the multitude of effects this has on a variety of different cultures and different groups of people, and it's really real. And what this presentation looks to do, after kind of going through some more entry-level conversations about the definition of what appropriation is, it goes on to link the real severity of it with other structures such as representation, and from an Indigenous context will link to dispossession, link to really serious things, and will examine just how critical this conversation is, because it is more than headdresses at Coachella, it's more than bindis, it's more than anything you see on this page, because in order to understand the real legacies of these images and the effects that they have, you have to link them to the tangible outcomes that people of color experience, and specifically from my perspective, the way that this impacts indigeneity and impacts the settler state and its direct relationship with dispossession and particularly representation. Hello.
Hi.
And so the question, what if America loved black people as much as black culture? I think that is a question that is a really important question to ask, and I will ask it around the concepts of indigeneity as well. So earlier I mentioned that within the realm of appropriation, there's a hyper-invisibility and a hyper-invisibility. So I'll ask you to think throughout this presentation about what it means when something is made overtly loud. So when you walk into YVR Airport and you are bombarded with art, and Coast Salish art is everywhere, and it can kind of create this idea that BC is this post-colonial province, that we are a woke province that is beyond colonization, because look at our relationship with Indigenous people and look at our relationship with art. That's that hyper-invisibility. And then later on in the conversation, particularly as it pertains to indigeneity, we talk about hyper-invisibility. So what does the utilization of images like this, how does that further render Indigenous people invisible? But most importantly, how does it render our issues and the complexities of a settler colonial body, colonized body, how does it render our issues invisible? So I think that question is really important, because the question of what if they liked our people as much as our culture, because what appropriation and the conversation really brings up is you can't have our culture and our aesthetic without our issues, which I'll elaborate on later. And the conversation around blackness, that could be somebody's whole PhD, right? But it's just an entrance point into this conversation. And so moving on to elaborate more on the effects of this conversation within indigeneity, and the conversation of hyper-visibility and invisibility, there's a quote by Sherman Alexie that says, "In the great American Indian novel, when it is finally written, all of the white people will be Indians and all of the Indians will be ghosts." So I think of that image in the beginning of the presentation where it says, "What's yours is mine." And what we've been told as Native people is that anything of ours is up for grabs. And the reason that the conversation around appropriation is so important is because it goes beyond, like I said, it goes beyond an aesthetic, and then that only then makes it okay for our bodies to be up for grabs, for our land to be up for grabs, for our water to be up for grabs, our art, our medicines. It gives a message that anything of ours is yours, and it's for the taking. So I have, in regards to Sherman's quote, that all the white people will be Indians and all the Indians will be ghosts, I have a little video by the 1491s to kind of demonstrate a little bit in a lighthearted way what I'm getting at, and also just when we talk about appropriation, the fact that you're in this room means you have some level of understanding about it, and that you're already not amongst the norm. You're already going upstream, right? But sometimes it can seem that this is so obvious to everybody else, or we run in circles where we're not having to have these conversations all the time necessarily, but it's not, and it's pervasive, and it's now, and it's in the news every day. So.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's the gist of their video. And the guy dancing around in the headdress is he is actually indigenous.
Thank God.
So the 1491s are a comedy duo. Has anyone seen any of their videos before? Well, y'all are missing out. And that's definitely a resource to tap into. But so that takes place in Santa Fe Indian Market, which is a really interesting kind of, like, it's just an interesting case study for questions of indigenous presence and art and authenticity. And it's the biggest indigenous artisan fair in North America. And so it draws a whole whack of people. And all the artisans are indigenous, and they don't, and all of this belongings at the fair, they're all handcrafted. There's really specific guidelines for what you can sell. And so it's a case study of examining, just what happens when different people come together with different understandings of indigeneity and art, and the lines between tokenism and celebration, and how that works. And so they reclaimed that, like, super racist song, "I'm an Indian Too," because no, you're not, and complicated it. And so I appreciated that. And also, there's only so much time in a day to gather as many kind of racist images as I could. It's really easy, because all you have to do is Google, like, American Indian. And those are the types of images that come up, but they did that for me, so that's really helpful. Because all those images that you see go to create a consciousness, and they tell a story. They tell a single story about indigeneity. And there are differences between representation in Canada and the States. And a lot of that imagery that you see will have a connotation with the States. But as far as North America's concerned, generally speaking, as far as the world is concerned, there is nothing outside of that image that the States has kind of rendered the authentic Indian or the vanishing Indian within people's consciousness or mindsets. And whether you're talking about the context of the American Indian or First Nations, Aboriginal, Inuit, Métis people, there is still an invisibility of a struggle, of a history of colonization, of a politic, and there is still appropriation of imagery, of music, of culture, of medicine that disregards the greater context, whether we're talking north or south of the border. And so it's important, I like to think that we're here to, like, that we're all here to grow these conversations and to learn from each other. And when we sat together and we were talking about planning for this presentation, I think probably if you've showed up here, like I said, you know cultural appropriation is bad, but you might not have the language to articulate exactly why, because it takes so much to consider just how there's so many structures that are all intertwined that move together to talk about just how damaging it is. But one thing, a common place where we have to start is that it isn't the common denominator within our culture and within Western society is not that it's wrong. That's not the common denominator. This is the common denominator, because when you look up cultural appropriation and the Urban Dictionary, the top definition, And I read, "The ridiculous notion that being of a different culture or race, especially white, in brackets, means that you are not allowed to adopt things from other cultures. This does nothing but support segregation and hinder progress in the world. All it serves to do is to promote segregation and racism." In quotations, "The plain-ass white bitch is wearing a bindi. That's classic cultural appropriation. Doesn't Osaka in Japan have a bastardized Americanized city? Isn't that cultural appropriation? Cultural appropriation only applies to white people, so that doesn't count. So there is a lot of defensiveness around this conversation, and there are a lot of white buts. So the white but is that instinct to be immediately defensive when called to account or when the word privileged is used, or a conversation starts to get uncomfortable, or something is being threatened to be taken from you that you think you should have. And when a lot of the time that immediate shoulder up reaction about feeling like you're going to lose something is because it's already been taken from someone else and someone else is asking for it back. And so that then begs a whole other conversation, a whole other presentation around reverse racism. Which is a thing. Because what, and we'll return to kind of what we were originally talking about with cultural appropriation, is it's inherently connected to power and inherently connected to privilege. So it's not somebody's culture and person and body and who they are is being threatened because it's being mentalized, it's being stolen, aspects of it are being completely decontextualized, and so it doesn't work the other way. That doesn't really enter the conversation. A more nuanced conversation is around like lateral appropriation amongst people of color, and that's a more nuanced conversation that belongs to people of color to talk to amongst themselves, because it's our business how we support each other. But that's not to derail that this issue of appropriation is inherently about power and privilege. It's not that there aren't always nuances to talk about and ways to become better and more accountable to each other, because there are, and nobody can sit here saying that that they know it all and that they haven't laterally run the risk of hurting someone else. And whether that was your intention or not doesn't really play into the equation. There's always room for people to grow, and the most important part is opening your ears to the people that that have been hurt or affected, listening to what people are telling you. And if they're telling you not to do something, then don't do it. But we're honoring you. The honoring you trope is a pretty, it's like a seemingly obviously easy one to debunk, but it's so common. And when it, like, even it doesn't have to be so obvious as the conversation around mascots, or at least how this, because obviously it's not obvious, the conversation around mascots, because there are so many racist ones that are still doing their thing. But the conversation and the rhetoric and the old trope of we're honoring you is tried, tested, and true, and it's people are using it all the time, and that's what I'm sure Charlie and Lee would say if I wrote to them and I said, you know, I find it pretty uncomfortable that I see sacred medicine being sold as an aesthetic within your shop. And what I would get back is something along these lines. And it's good to put this in your toolbox as you gain the language to debunk myths around cultural appropriation and myths around what it means to honor somebody, because this isn't it. There's a blog called Cultural Appropriations, and she put this little bingo sheet together, and it kind of explores some of the main things that you'll hear in response to the like in response to talking about cultural appropriation. So don't you have something more important to worry about? Other countries appropriate things from America. I just wear, read, and watch this because I think it's cool. Fashion, art, music, film always borrows from other sources, which is a really important point that we'll hold on to and put in our back pocket as we further the conversation around art, because there is a lot of nuance within art and around borrowing, but it is still intrinsically linked to power and privilege, even though history and the art world and the music world and the film world tries to tell you it's not. It is. I asked the person from that culture, and she said it was okay. It's just art, fashion, movies, you know, genre, fiction. I lived in another country for years. That isn't cultural, that's iconic. This fashion, religion, music really speaks to me on a level that white stuff doesn't. I don't find this offensive. I'm just showing appreciation for that culture. If you don't like it, don't buy it, don't read it, don't watch it. There's no such thing as white culture. Stereotypes exist because they have truth in them. So because I'm white, I'm automatically racist? You're just trying to tell everyone what to think. I'm just filling a niche. If I didn't offer this, someone else would. Also really common. But I'm doing it respectfully. First you were mad because everything was Anglo-centric. Make up your mind. You're just looking for something to be offended about. So if I wear them clothing, I'm a racist? White people experience racism too. This is promoting understanding between cultures. White culture is boring. So it's important to like to go through this list, and it's so helpful that she created it because whether or not you're at this workshop because you yourself experience your culture being appropriated daily and it's really exhausting and you want to sit around in and around a conversation that's going to critically just debunk that and hold space for that it's just not okay, or whether you're here because you're continually seeing other people's culture being appropriated and it's not okay anymore, and you want to have language to address the issue and to identify it. It's for me, I hear this kind of shit all the time, and I have to defend myself against these kind of statements all the time. And if that's not your reality, it's really good that you know this is the kind of shit that people are uttering, so that you have just those same tools in your basket to debunk those and to be able to explain why it isn't just an honoring, why it isn't just a culture, why we're not just complaining again, you know? But that same trope is so tired, and it gets put on people of color all the time. Like, it's put on Indigenous people all the time. You're just complaining again. This is just another thing to complain about. First it was this, now it was this, and it gets really exhausting. But this whole presentation is to try and show just what's at stake here, and that it isn't just a dog wearing a headdress from Urban Outfitters, that it is connected to a lot more. And so, speaking of Urban Outfitters, this was a picture of a line of like Navajo wear that they're selling, and there's a flask, some undies, some socks with some kind of like Navajo-esque style designs, and they were taken to court by the Navajo Nation. And this was a while ago, and this is what kind of triggered the Native Appropriations blog, because this was like 5 years ago or whenever, when this kind of geometric aesthetic became really popular. It was totally detached from an idea that it might come from somewhere. It's all good. It's totally detached from an idea that these designs might have a greater context. And so then you have Urban Outfitters saying, like, hey, yo, like, everything we do is inspired by something. And, yeah, we're not Like, we're not ripping you off, we're just honoring you. Or we didn't take this from a specific rug, like, we made it on our computer. Like, all these just, like, it's a, like, whatever the excuse, what it does is it turns a culture, it turns a history, it turns a people into just an aesthetic, into something you can buy into something you can put on, but most importantly, something you can take off. So I really thank Urban Outfitters for such a poignant example of privilege, right? Because you can take off the design, but you don't wear it. And so I have this tattoo design on my arm. You'll see. Not unlike what we see on the screen here. But this design is an ancestral weaving design, and it's like my family's crest. The design is a Chief Joseph design, and that's the chieftainship name that my father, Squarquamtin Siem, carries. And it means the leader who stands on the mountain and looks after his people as long as the eye can see. And so colonization on the coast is so recent that I only have 3 sets of grandparents that have English names. Beyond them, it's just Squarquamtin Siem, Squarquamtin Siem, Squarquamtin Siem. So when I look at my family tree, this is my dad, Chief Floyd Joseph, Squarquamtin, Larry Joseph, Squarquamtin, Moses Joseph, Squarquamtin, and then from beyond there, Squarquamtin Siem. And each generation fought for this design, fought for what it means to think about family, to think about community. And then my aunties, they fought to bring this design back into wool. And that meant going completely upriver and sifting for the knowledge of how to wool weave that was so nearly lost on the coast because it was kept from us. So there's this whole history embedded with who we are as Squamish people, who I am as a Joseph, who I am as the daughter of Squarquamtin Siem, and come from a long line of people that carried that name. And embedded in resistance, embedded in what my aunties did so that I could know of this design, so I could wear it on my body, so that I could wear it on my regalia and on my drum. So that's what this design is. That's what these designs are. That then get completely taken out of context and put onto flasks, onto socks, onto underwear. They get put on in the beginning of the day and they get taken off in the end. But they don't have to, the people wearing these designs don't necessarily have to wear not only the immense privilege that comes with the design of that kind of nature. They don't have to think about that, they don't get to think about that, but they don't have to wear the burden. They don't have to wear the burden of colonization, they don't have to wear that grief. And you can, any form of cultural appropriation, a person of color can sit there and walk you through a really similar story that I did around the significance of something that's been taken out of its context. That's, so without even linking this conversation to where we're going, to talk about dispossession, to talk about representation or violence, even on just on a baseline level of respect and ignorance, it's so important to know the story of what you're buying, of what you're condoning, of the stories that you're listening to, who's telling them, and that you're listening to the right storytellers, and that you're buying from the right artists. The relationship between representation and appropriation. So, I love talking about representation. And that's, it was always going to make its way into any presentation you asked me to do because it's so interesting and important. And the most important thing about it is that it has really lived consequences, really tangible, felt consequences on the lives of people. Because representation tells a story about who someone is, And it tells a story about how you can treat someone. It tells you what's acceptable, and it funnels a really convenient truth about a people, and it erases context and nuance, and is entirely driven by the power of norms and the power of whiteness and the power of one lens and one single story. So I don't know, maybe some of you saw this saw at least some of the iterations when Nicki Minaj had released her her magazine covers, and then people were doing all this fan art, and she reposted it, and it's an important example that includes both appropriation and the issues of representation, all nicely wrapped up in one little package for me to explain just how damaging this is, because what representation of Indigenous women, for example, has done through Pocahontas is it's told a single story about Native women as either being the princess or the squaw. So there's this dichotomy that gets put on our bodies, and we're either like Sacagawea, we're either Pocahontas, we're somebody who is like very like beautiful and sexual, and we want nothing more than for our John Smith to reach his goal. We want to help him. We want to further the process of colonization. We will not get in your way. We're gorgeous to look at. Or we are degenerate, uneducated, also sexual. We can't escape that. That's just ingrained in who we are as Native women. And so images like this that would take Native women's bodies and use them without our permission, and take an already racist Pocahontas depiction of who we are and further sexualize something already sexualized, something already inaccurate, something already racist and offensive. What it does is it only reiterates that Native women are a single thing, there's a single story about who we are, and the representation of Native women that's been found in film and in the media and in what have you, that gives people an understanding of how we can be treated. So when you represent us as backwards, as degenerate, as this or as that, when we go missing, you just don't care as much because we had it coming, or this is a natural progression, or that's the risks of poverty, or that's the risks of sex work, or this is kind of the natural state of affairs, or maybe you don't know at all because you're not listening. But what it does is it tells a story about how people can be treated. And so when you dress up as a sexy Indian princess on Halloween, it reiterates all types of stories. But sexualizing a real person, sexualizing me, only makes my life just that much harder and that much more dangerous, because all it is reaffirming notions that people have in their mind. And you naturalize things. As humans, we are so susceptible to what's happening around us and the stories that are being told, that we'll naturalize stories that we hear. People ask me questions all the time that just come from a place of having been naturalized. Like, are you actually more susceptible to like alcohol than other people? And I'm like, no. That's biological racism. It's a story you've been told over and over again, but you hear it so many times, you just think perhaps it's true. And so that's the risk of appropriation on a greater level. It only one reaffirms that we can take what we want from people, and that's okay. But those individual images that we promote have lived effects on people. So here, there's a cartoon that says, non-white babies now outnumber white babies in America for the first time. And there's this elder that's like, whoa, a second. And so when you have, so we have that same woman dressed up as a sexy Indian princess for Halloween, not only does it, like when you, if you step aside from the gendered lens around normalized, perpetualized violence against Indigenous women, it's, if you step outside of that very pressing, very important lens, it still tells a story that this is a costume based on some kind of imagination of somebody that was, not somebody that is. And you see that at Halloween across all cultures. And what it does is it tells you that these people don't exist, or that culture is something of the past. These people are something of the past. And around indigeneity, it further creates this notion that Native people no longer exist. Which seems crazy when we go, if we step a little ways back to the conversation we were having about the airport, for example. Like, how could, in the context of BC, where we land in the airport and we see weavings and we see art, Northwest Coast art, it's in our gift shops, it's on coffee mugs, it's everywhere. You think, well, how could people argue that Native people exist? But that's what I'm saying around, it's one or the other. It's hyper-visibility, where it's a total tokenized celebration that's loud and everywhere, and it's a commodification of that culture. So it's, it takes a part of a culture and it makes money a culture, but it ignores the rest. And then you have the other extreme end, as I'm saying, where indigeneity gets then seen as a thing of the past, and it gets totally erased, and who we are as people, our stories, our language, our culture, it's dead or it's dying. Which even in this context is still a really common held belief. All you have to do is walk into a museum as an example of this idea that we have to hold on and protect what was because it's on its way out and they don't know how to protect it themselves. But representation matters. And the stories that were told, they really start to impact how you see yourself, how you're treated, and how you move through the world. And so what's important is to highlight the multitude of voices and people that resist single stories about themselves around indigeneity that force their voice onto platforms, force their bodies into spaces to complicate people's notions of indigeneity and to complicate the conversations around appropriation to show just how high the stakes are. This is just a little example of one of the several resources there are around people that are trying to complicate this conversation.
Proud. Forgotten. Indian. Navajo. Blackfoot. Inuit and Sioux. Survivor. Spiritualist. Patriot. Sitting Bull. Hiawatha. And Jim Thorpe. Mother. Father. Son. Daughter. Chief. Apache. Pueblo. Choctaw. Chippewa and Crow, underserved, Rogers, Geronimo. Unyielding, strong, indomitable. Native Americans call themselves many things. The one thing they don't.
So I wish that I was showing you this video and I was using this as an example of some crazy conversation that the generation before me had to deal with, that that people would walk around with extremely racist characteristics of themselves on shirts, that they would have to see that their children would have to see that. I wish I could tell you that was something that the generations before me had to deal with, but it's happening right now. And all those sports teams that have those racist logos are still thriving without question. And what it tells you is that is the state of affairs. It tells you how far we've actually come, despite seeing, like on the coast, despite seeing art all around us, and this, which offers a suggestion that perhaps we're post-colonial now, perhaps we're no longer racist. Mm-hmm. What this does is it shows you where we're actually at, that anti-Indigenous racism is so far out of people's scopes that a racist characteristic, that racist slanderous names such as Redskins, is still the norm today, and that it's still appropriate and acceptable. But what I really like about the video is just that it makes me realize as a Native person how few images I get to see of other Native people that are positive, that show that kind of diversity. And how seldom I get to see people that look like me up on a screen like that. And how often I get to see characteristics of myself on that screen, and how there's such an imbalance there. And so this conversation's so important, because the more people that have it, the less likely it's gonna be just that much more devastating for me to have to explain to my future children why something like that's okay. Why racist characteristics of who we are as Indigenous people can be worn on hats and jerseys and shirts and foam hands. And that's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to think about having that conversation with my future children. So the more we have conversations like this, the more I might not have to have that conversation. And hopefully my kids can be like, oh, you'll never believe what my mom had to deal with. It's like crazy fucked up racist thing. It's so messed up. And everyone will be like, that's a really embarrassing part of our history. And that's what I hope for. So appropriation, it tells different narratives. So we started by talking about what's yours is mine, and I can take it, and I'm gonna, but don't take it back from me, because that would be racist. So we had that conversation, but it also tells a story, anything you can do, I can do better. So this is just to step outside of my own lens for a little bit. I loved this when it happened, when Azealia Banks was going after Iggy Azalea on Twitter. And it was such an interesting conversation around appropriation, and I think it polarized things really well. Despite how you might feel about Azealia Banks and her other Twitter rampages, this one is particularly polarizing around the conversation of appropriation. So in the context, this was a few years ago, and in the context of Black Lives Matter, it was really bubbling to a front, and Azealia Banks was her career, or Iggy Azalea, who Azalea Banks calls Igloo Australia. her career was like rising, and she was doing so well. For those of you that might not know who she is, she's a white female rapper from Australia. And so the Black Lives Matter throughout social media, it's in Twitter, it's like it's really starting to take hold. And Azalea Banks says, it's funny to see people like Igloo Australia silent when these things happen. Black culture is cool, but black issues sure aren't, huh? And Iggy Azalea says, now rant, make it racial, make it political, make it whatever, but I guarantee it won't make you likable. And that's why you're crying on the radio. And in an interview, Azalea Banks says, that Macklemore album wasn't better than the Drake record. That Iggy Azalea shit isn't better than any fucking black girl that's rapping today. The Grammys are supposed to be accolades of artistic excellence. Iggy Azalea is not excellent. And so what's happening here is, and I repeat, anything you can do, I can do better. With what Azalea Banks highlights, if you read further into her interviews and her Twitter conversations, and something that is extremely relatable is the idea that whiteness is still the ultimate level of value. It's still going to be what everything gets compared against to find value. So she says, Macklemore album wasn't better than Drake's album, and Macklemore won Best Rapper of the Year. But when what that does is it tells you a story that anything you can do, I can do better. So you have white rappers such as Iggy Azalea, Macklemore, Eminem stepping into black spaces and being told, because they can do something that almost sounds black, or because they can do something that almost sounds like what we're used to hearing, now all of a sudden it becomes polarized as being really valuable. But then the most important part of the conversation is what she stresses: black culture is cool, but black issues sure aren't, huh? So within the context of Black Lives Matter in the States, within the polarizing of critical race politics and injustice and structures in America, as a white rapper, you can be like, nah, thanks, and you can step out of that because you have that choice. You have the ability to move in and out of spaces, to take what you want, to take what will be comfortable for you, what's relatable for you, what can make you successful, and you can brush your hands of the rest. And so I just think it's like, it was a polarized kind of conversation that happened within, these are all really famous figures, but there's a lot of nuance and really interesting conversations around critical race and appropriation and moving in and out of spaces and taking bits and pieces of culture but leaving the rest. I think it was just a interesting example. And I'm not, like, just as I said in the beginning of the presentation, I can only speak to indigeneity, so I can't speak to a history of blackness in America, what that feels like, what Azalea Banks feels like, and how blackness operates. I can't speak from that perspective, but I can highlight other people that are speaking from it and that are doing it well, and that are bringing important questions to this conversation and busting open the music world. And it is polarizing when Iggy Azalea says, it won't make you likable, and that's why you're crying on the radio. And it sure as hell didn't make her likable. And she took a perhaps irreparable career hit from this conversation alone. And there were a plethora of black rappers that came to Iggy Azalea's defense. And Azalea Banks had to take on the weight and the responsibility of having this conversation to the detriment of her own career, because it's so unpopular to have these conversations. I'm not going to stand behind everything she does or says, but but this is a an important conversation that she busted open that a lot of people don't want to have or think about. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you. So, do you remember hearing this headline in the news? This was not too long ago, just a few months ago, I guess, like in the spring or something like that. Toronto Gallery cancels exhibit of white artists' paintings over complaints of cultural appropriation. So this is Amanda, and she said her work was inspired by the Woodland School of Art, and she acknowledged a similarity to the work of Anishinaabe artist Norvell Morisot. And even the headline that's supposed to be like, that's supposed to be neutral, pisses me off. It's like, complaints of cultural appropriation. Complaints as though this isn't grounds to be fucking pissed off.
Yeah.
Because as you kind of open up this conversation more, even if it was just work that was largely inspired by him, it's not okay, but there were like direct replicas. What's the judge's name that was involved in the TRC work, the native judge that...
Sinclair?
Yeah.
Marie Sinclair.
Yeah, so Marie Sinclair got in on this conversation, and he's a prolific public Indigenous figure who has largely been affiliated with the TRC, and he had said, like, something along the lines of, like, he tried to defend her, and then people, like, racists love when a person of color or minority, when they can spin their words or they can use them as an example for why something like this is okay. And tried to talk about appropriation, but you had people saying, like, hey, look, even outside of how uncomfortable the conversation of cultural appropriation makes you, what about plagiarism? That's what you tell every university student that rolls through campus, that you can't plagiarize. So when this woman is doing exact replicas of Norvell Morisot's art, and people are all coming to her defense, saying that Native people are too picky and they're too sensitive, you have people saying, like, hold up, this is so beyond the scope of just the nuance of cultural appropriation. It's literally just plagiarism. It just busted open in people's purviews just how many blind spots there are to this conversation. And again, you have, just like the conversation we had previously around Azalea Banks and Iggy Azalea, you have two people that are doing the same thing. One person, Iggy Azalea. their names are so similar. Her whiteness is going to bring her beyond the scope of where the blackness could have ever taken her. And so this white woman, she's going to have an entire exhibit in a Toronto art gallery. Her whiteness is going to take her far beyond anywhere where indigeneity can take you in this country, because there are so many confines within the barriers of settler colonialism and racism and what's normalized. So power and privilege, again, I can't underline just how key it is to the conversation of appropriation, because all of it works for this woman to have thought that this is okay, and all of it works for this woman to have made a living off of this, and to excel her to a point of having her work in a gallery, but it was plagiarized. And so I'm sure that Amanda is a nice woman. She's got some work to do, and it isn't just on an extreme level like this that where people need to be interrogating their actions. But this was a news article that happened just months ago, and it really showed just how important these conversations are and this work is. And also, I also can't stress that it's not, that what she can only possibly touch the aesthetic. That's all she can reach with a replica of Norvell's art. So one of my best friends, Quill Christie, who's also Anishinaabe, like more so, she's an amazing artist, and I wear her art on my arm. And I know every significance that she put into this design, that she designed for me and some of my best girlfriends. I know her process of creating. I know her relationship to the territory where her designs come from, or her body, where her experience with herself and story come from, in a relationship to self, to home, to ancestors. And as a non-Indigenous person that's creating art, not unlike what's on my arm here, you can only touch this, you can only break the surface as an aesthetic, and that's as far as you can possibly go. So what a bummer for her, you know? What an empty way to produce something that has the potential to be so gratifying, if you can speak to what you know, and she doesn't know this. Canadian journalists support appropriation prize after online furor. So, do you remember this article? Some of you remember it? Yeah, so we don't have to go into it too much, because some of the main kind of concepts that we've been talking about, we've really explored, and it's been an hour now, so you're probably getting kind of tired of my voice. But this really just polarizes, again, the blind spots around appropriation, but he suggested that there is some sort of like objectiveness of exploring people's experiences, and as though it could somehow make your art practice more compelling if you could put yourself into other people's shoes. And I understand that idea. Why don't you walk a mile in someone else's shoes? Sure, you can try and picture what an experience of residential school is for somebody else, because that's also been another hot topic this year, people writing like poems or whatever about a fake experience in residential school as white writers, which is fucked. So you can try and in your head take a walk in somebody else's shoes, but don't tell people what that was like as though you know, and don't make money off of it. There's some pretty simple things here, some pretty like big missteps that are occurring here. So the idea that you could put yourself into other people's shoes, sure, it might have value in theory and concept, but in practice, how you do it, how you profit off of it, and how you retell others what their experience was, it's so dangerous. And proposing that there be a prize for it only shows you, how uncommon these conversations are. And then when you start to unpack the conversation that we've been having, you see that it just grows. The conversation only grows. You start at a headdress on a pug on your shirt, or you start with geometric Indigenous designs on your underwear, and then we end up here at the end of the presentation, a conversation around land. So so you talk about appropriation, then you talk, and we've talked about its relationship to representation and the stories we tell, how much hold they have on how a costume can it directly impact how somebody might treat me, or how they might think that they can get away with their treatment of my body because they've been told a story about Native women. They've been told a narrative about my sexuality, and they believe it before they meet me. So we can talk about representation, and we've talked about what's hyper-invisible, what's hyper-visible. We've talked about taking bits and pieces, and as you continue to take, it starts with headdresses and medicine, but when you work up, the conversation comes to a bigger problem of taking, where nothing is sacred and everything is up for grabs, and an indigeneity becomes not only something we can all have in culture, but something we can physically have in land. And the conversation about what's mine is, and yours is a time-old tale of terra nullius, of empty land, that brings us to a contemporary occupation that is only justified by that this land is your land, this land is my land, this land is empty land, what's mine is yours, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is still mine. So the conversation of appropriation to have in an hour, or to have in an hour and a half, or whatever, it encompasses a lot, and it's a big task to try and to try and move fluidly through definitions, to move through my own experiences, to move through my own ancestry, and then to try and contextualize it within a bigger scope of what's expendable, of what is stealable, and try and bust open just how important a conversation is, my own vested interest in it, and just how much emotion is attached to it, and that this is has real tangible outcomes. And and there are ways to, for all of us to see red flags. And I'd hope we have some time at the end to maybe talk about what happens when you see those red flags, or what happens if you've fucked up, and how do we make it better? Because that feeling of discomfort when you're like, I don't know if this is right, like, it's something to listen to, and we all get it. And just as I mentioned, even laterally across people of color, we get that too when we think about how to interact with other people of color in a respectful way, when all we can only know the protocols and respect of our own people. So learning protocols and respect of other people just takes time and listening. But it takes intentional action too. It's not just going to come to you by osmosis. So, not my intention. So moving beyond apologies. So that brings us kind of to a conversation around. Sorry, my earrings are showing up. Brings us to a conversation around what, like, how do we hold ourselves or others accountable to blind spots, and when we do mess up, and we've now acknowledged that there are consequences on for appropriation and representation on people, and there are not only way bigger things at stake, but there's also just like heartache at stake and dignity and everyday feelings of belonging and safety that we all deserve. How do we make it right, I guess, is a question that I have that I can't answer by myself. So David asked me to talk about the design that CITR did on, what was it on?
Pop Alliance Records, is that what it was?
Yeah.
The album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it like on Google somewhere, or is it online somewhere?
Yeah, you can bring it up. It's, if you search CITR Mint Records Pop Alliance, the Bandcamp page should come up.
Pardon?
CITR Mint Records Pop Alliance. And then Bandcamp, like the fifth link at the bottom.
This one?
Oh, is that the right one? Okay, yeah, that works too.
Can I not click on it? Or?
I don't know if There might be a bigger image on Bandcamp, so if you were
I guess people can see it. You guys can see it. So, David just asked me, he's like, sorry, you guys going to talk about that, like, awkward album that we hate? That's, like, this, like, blemish on who we are. And it's like, I'm like, sure, we can talk about it. I think that this conversation, like, for some people, a lot of it would have been intuitive, or like a lot of it you maybe even heard before, and then some of it wasn't. Some of it's total new language, and I think that there's like we've gone, like we talked about representation and how it relates to murdered and missing Indigenous women and violence and settler colonialism and land dispossession, which sets the stakes high. But also, within this conversation, there is room for people to grow, and there is room for people to fuck up, and there is room for people to make mistakes and then learn later why something wasn't cool. So it's not about, it doesn't have to be about shame. I mean, there are some things in my presentation that were like, shame on you, that was very bad. but there is a... This conversation's useless if we expect people to get from 0 to 100 without messing up along the way, without being open to blind spots, and blind spots that are so often, like I think about being like a deer in the headlights, and those headlights are our blind spots to the things that we don't experience. So every day I'm like, in public spaces, calling them public spaces, moving through them, like trying to understand my own identity and the things that I face, but I have I'm constantly a deer in the headlights as it pertains to gender or being like a cisgendered woman. So I get to go into a public space and I walk into a ladies' room, no problem. I don't have to think about gender-neutral washrooms. I don't have to. That's an example of it. Of me being in the headlights where I just, there's things I don't see, and I'm really trying to open my eyes up to the issue, and it's imperfect as I go along, but I can't learn more about something that I don't experience if I don't listen to the people that experience it, that are telling me how something feels and what they need. So all that is to say that you put out a picture like this, and you know that it, just like the tattoo on my arm that we talked about, you know that just as these designs for my people are sacred, you know that totem poles are sacred too. And you know, just as I talked to you about the story and intention, the story of not only beauty and resistance, colonization, all of the intricacies that are embedded on my arm, are embedded in a totem pole too. And so within the conversation, we debunked why this is offensive. It just, now it then leads to a conversation of, well, what do you do now? What do you do when you have, when you know that you messed up, and that that people are still gonna see this and they're gonna wonder, well, where do you need to be more respectful, because like we can link this picture to bigger structures that we've talked about, but at the baseline, just as I said, it's about dignity and about respect. For a while, and I know that that there's a lot of intention around what to do, and bringing me in was one of the things. So I mean, we are living what it means to move forward now together in this room. But I guess that leaves some room for conversation amongst us around what do we do when we see it, if we've done it, if we are trying to call it out. It leaves room for a conversation, I guess. So I think with that, I will I'll end my part of the presentation, and open it up for any questions or comments, but I really thank you all for coming and listening to me speak and work through a really intricate issue the best I could. So thank you. It's okay if you have to go, you'll do it.